Okay, welcome to the Stage Left Podcast, lifting the veil on the music industry by telling the stories of those with a unique vantage point. This podcast exists to provide free educational content for young musicians entering an increasingly complex industry by telling the stories of some of the unsung heroes behind the success. Today we have psychotherapist Adam Fysek, who draws on his experience as former writer and drummer in Baby Shambles and his impressive solo output as Roses, King's Castles to support those in the music industry through Music and Mind, which is established to provide support, therapy, consultancy and well-being in the music industry. Today I'll be finding out about how direct experiences have led to the creation of Music and Mind, what specific actions musicians can take right now, what a changed world in the future looks like around this area. We'll be discussing the creative processes of writing with Pete Doherty and what it was like being in the Lars for two whole days. So it's a pleasure to say that our guest today on the Stage Left Podcast is none other than Adam Fysek. Thanks for joining us today, Adam. How's it going?
Good, thanks. Yeah, it's been a full-on day, but I'm here.
Good stuff. So you've been doing your Music and Mind stuff today, would that be right?
I've been doing that, yeah. I work with people on a generally on a part-time thing. I do 2 days a week. At the moment, I'm 1 day in the NHS as well, in a doctor's surgery up in Oxford. And the rest of the time is a bit of teaching, a bit of performing, just juggling multitude of musical type things.
And the stuff around supporting musicians specifically, there's a real need for that, isn't there, at the moment, would you say?
I think at the moment and generally ongoing. I think there's always been this void of support. I think it's been inflated recently from this recent spate of suicides and high-profile artists. I think it's come to people's attention that there needs to be some kind of duty of care in the industry, because it is one of those industries where one minute you're the top of the game and the next minute you're not. You're struggling for support, financially, status, all these different things which can really be quite overwhelming. Without, you know, I don't think there's anyone to blame. I think it's quite easy to just point the finger and say it's the industry's fault. A lot of my research goes into how people bring their own psychological baggage to their journey and then unpicking that within the struggles they face in allowing people to take some agency over it. Because I think sometimes, like all of us, it's easy just to go, it's all their fault, it's all because of this, it's all because of that. Which I think that leaves us in quite a position that we can't change much. And I do believe in everything that we all co-contribute in a certain way to a different level or not. So that's been the biggest insight, really, working with people, seeing what they got out of their industry journey, what they now really feel they need in their life, and dealing with either people that are going through big struggles, i.e. some people it's from the industry side of things that you know, are trying to find work and struggling to do that and to maybe give them some insight into their transferable skills, alongside high-profile musicians that are struggling to continue the wide-scale touring and flying and all that kind of stuff and questioning what they want to do.
The business model has changed in music drastically in the last kind of 15-20 years, as we know. Is there a link between that? So you just mentioned about the amount of bands have to tour now probably to make their earning because they don't make so much money from releases. Has that seen an influx in people interested in what you do in that field, do you think?
I think so. I think the pressures are innately growing. I think now people have to, you know, we briefly discussed earlier, like to have a variety of roles, especially when you're not at the top echelon of the big money. The first thing is I think there's a massive widening gap, I guess like in football, between the low-level touring bands who are trying to make it and the massive old, I guess, ingrained brands that are bands that are still doing the tours, which they never would have done 10 years ago because the income was coming in from royalties. So that leaves, I think, a lot less opportunity for young bands. I think because of that, the income's a lot less than it was before. I think there's this demand now to have content over time, which leaves a massive mark. You know, the social media world we live in, I think it's really, really quite a potent force in disabling people's mental health, to be honest.
How?
I think it is. I think that constant demand, that insatiable demand for more, more, more. And of course, the biggest issue I have with that is that people feel like they're being really vulnerable and very authentic on it, but there's very few examples of where people are real on their social media. So they're creating this kind of false self, delivering that to the world because it's becoming more and more prominent. I think it leaves a massive vacuum between who they really are and who they're trying to project who they are. Generally, I mean, that's not even leaning into if you're in a band now, you know, on a very small scale. I've got a toe in the music industry. I haven't got a foot in anymore. I've got a toe in, and that suits me fine. And even on that level, I'll get tentatively in touch with some managers or agents, and you know, what's your social media? How many Instagram? It's like, I don't want to indulge in that.
Yeah,
it's not. I just find it really mundane. I'm trying to sell something which isn't that real. I'm trying to promote this one element of me. And I do think it's disengaging for all of us. I think that on a level, we all buy into it. But
and what are the main anxieties that people have? I know it's probably a really broad question. But one thing I think with the current business model and that demand that you mentioned is, do you think it's having an effect on the actual artistic output people are putting out? Because it's a bit more short term, isn't it?
I agree.
They have to write big singles rather than actually develop as an artist. I think quality
has massively suffered. I also feel that, you know, the rise of the electronic artists, I find something really, really interesting. A lot of my friends, you know, I kind of straddle between electronica and a lot of traditional guitar based stuff. Depending where I'm at, I'll need to do more production or I'll need to do more really kind of organic instrument stuff. And, you know, I think the rise of that, because I've got good friends that can knock out a track in a day, you know, that's their thing, and it's okay to deliver to whatever Beatport want an exclusive or someone want this. That's a day's work. As a songwriter or a guitar player, you know, to do that in a day is pretty hard work, even if you're self-recording, because you want to sculpt it. So I think, you know, the rise of electronic music has made it slightly more disposable. But then I think people generally, they want disposability. There seems to be a bigger demand for a quick turnover of just more, rather than someone, you know, someone's going to have an album and really ingest that and indulge that album for 2 or 3 years. I feel I'm seeing that at the moment, whether or not that, I don't think that's a good thing for art especially, but it's a consumer-led market. If you're talking about commoditized commercial music, you know, if we're talking about just pure musicians making art, whatever, but if you're talking about especially the pop or the indie scene or those scenes which are more commoditized, if the demand's there, you know, by the law of economics, you've got to deliver. So it's not as if people really have a choice.
And do you find that in some of the therapy that you offer, that is a theme, that people are kind of having this internal conflict with what they actually want to create and put out and what they're being asked to put out or what they need to put out to be heard and seen?
I agree. I think, and as always, I think even if we step aside the music environment, I think that's in all of us, isn't it? It's that innate anxiety between what we want and what we have to do. That's kind of from an existential perspective, that's part of being a human being. We're continually juggling. And I do believe there is an innate anxiety of being a human being anyway, but obviously when anxiety gets to pathology, it's a different level. But in the industry, I hear that a lot. I really want this, whether that's be, you know, alluding to all this output and, no, we have to do this. So we have to deliver. We have to do this PR campaign. We have to do this series of tour dates. Don't really want to do it, but it's going to feed into the, I guess, commercialization of the album. It's going to enhance sales. I think people get trapped as well. And you get caught on the merry-go-round and it just becomes how it is. And then it takes a bit of a big rupture or shake-up for people to kind of stop, have a break and think, well, hold on, what do we really want here? Because what we want as artists probably isn't going to collaborate with what the management or the label want. It's always been that way, I guess. I just think now it's probably more intense because of the world we live in so much faster. So I do think that's a real big struggle.
And it's the interpretation, the internal interpretation of the word success as well. What does success look like to the individual?
So, I mean,
we've had people on, I know someone who's living, to an outsider, would be living the dream. So many musicians would love to be. But actually, the artistic output that he has to put out isn't what he wants to be. And he's actually quite unhappy.
I hear that all the time.
People
that have had swathes of money, they've got as much money as they ever wanted, and they're desperately unhappy because they feel now, because people get accustomed to a certain way of living, if they don't continue along this path that they have ended up despising, they're not going to earn the same amount of money, therefore be able to maintain that lifestyle. Then it's about sitting with that person and working out, well, what does that money give you other than the money? What does this give you other than that? How important is it for you to be a creative artist? And it's a decision ultimately no one can make for that person. It's something they're going to have to come to. But I think through therapy, you can kind of see all the different streams that are feeding those big decision points. So then giving someone clarity and sitting with them and say, look, it's a decision you can only make, really. But we've got a bit of clarity on this now, so you're a bit more informed. Do you want to be this high-profile pop artist earning this much money and having this lifestyle? If you do, this is the price. If you don't, then this is the price.
This is the price, yeah.
There's three decisions here. You either continue, don't continue, or you choose not to do any of those things. Sometimes it's easier to continue on the path which, but with clarity, so then you commit to it. So, okay, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this for 10 years. I really don't like doing it, but I know it's going to pay, whatever, $500,000 a year, and I'm going to probably, yeah, I'm not going to have anything else apart from that, because then it takes away all the intrapsychic stress and all that tension, because you've committed.
Yeah.
It might not be what you want to do, but I think if you formalise it and say, well, okay, this is what we're going to do, I think that eases it sometimes, because ultimately those decisions can only be made by the person that's kind of holding the reins.
On that subject, leads me nicely to a quote that you said a while ago, which was, I did previously hold playing Wembley and Glastonbury as momentous occasions, but with more insight, I no longer feel that is the case. So what was that insight, and why was that perspective not visible at the time?
I think when you're caught in the whirlwind of being on that, in that world of the commercial music industry, I think they're kind of quite high points. And they always were. Of course, they were high points. But I think through the infrastructure, you know, you're on that kind of conveyor belt, as it were. And it was a good conveyor belt to be on. You know, I'd done well out of it. Not begrudging it at all. But I think it's those things that you fantasize about, then you play them, and the opportunity comes and you do it. And for me, it just felt a bit void. It just felt a bit, I feel really disconnected from the fans, probably from myself at that point anyway, from, I guess, more of what was going on for me. But it just felt a bit short. It just felt a bit empty. It's the same as the NME covers and all that stuff. For me, growing up, you know, I'd cycle back from some hellhole of a factory, having to do some really crap job during the summer, and look at the Reading posters and think, oh, wow, one day. And that's a lovely essence to get somebody through life, this fantasy. Sometimes it's more dangerous to realise that fantasy, because then you're through it and think, now what do I have? Now so, my dream's no longer there. Wow, that's scary.
So I don't know if you know Johnny Wilkinson, who's a rugby player. He dropped the final kick in the last minute of 2003 of the World Cup. And it was like the dream thing. And he said the first thing he felt afterwards was really depressed, because he'd realised his whole life goals that's had been it. Met. It's like, what the fuck do I do now? You actually said also that you said Baby Shambles had incredible highs and incredible lows. Wembley was an amazing experience, and the buzz and that kind of thing. Although I quickly realised the music industry wasn't what I had imagined it to be. So how does it differ from being on the inside to what you imagined it to be?
Well, and this is a tough question, because how I imagined it to be, there is no real... I didn't really build up any notion of what I expected it to be honest. It's a really hard question, because, yeah, it wasn't what I expected it to be, but what did I expect it to be? And what was it not? I think it was definitely more... I realised that, for example, you know, you can buy media, so you can buy all the PR stuff. In my naivety, I expected that, you know, you get radio play, and it sounds really quite comical now, from what I know.
I don't think it will to the people who listen to
music, but
so it's interesting.
You imagine, you think, oh yeah, someone's going to like your record, so they'll play it. Enemy are going to think you're great, so they'll put you on a cover. I mean, talking about the Enemy is even defunct now anyways. Yeah. But these little things, put, you know, in front of MySpace, and you really don't know, that's because somebody scratched the back of somebody else, or somebody's funded that to happen. And there's this whole infrastructure on the facade of the band. I always use the analogy between a band. Yeah, we were good. We had all our, you know, all of our merits. But within sport, I always thought that if you're a sportsman and you're running 100 metres, you have to win that race. The person that came first is the winner of that race. There's no qualms.
Yeah.
In band land or in commercial music, it's not the case. You haven't really even got to be that good at points. You've got such a collection of blagging, of, yeah, you've got a bit of talent, but it's all about the sizzle, not the steak. That's what I felt a bit. Maybe it's the value in our experience, because I know there's a lot of fans that and I thought we were great when we were on form, etc. But I see a lot of artists now, and I think, where's the substance anymore? I think there's been such a massive... I think the art of selling something has become so powerful that with the right, you know, smash of media, you can probably sell anything if you've got enough influence for a period of time. It might not have longevity. That was my biggest head scratcher. I'm thinking, oh wow, so it's a bit like just a big game with a small nucleus. Yeah, we're musicians and we're doing our thing. Because I came from a music degree background where people were putting in 8-9 hours a day practice. And you realise it's not even about that in that industry. It's about how they're going to market you. you know,
USPs, all that kind of thing.
What's the ethos of the band? You know, oh, okay, Rebellion, okay, teenagers like Rebellion, blah, blah, blah. All this stuff on top of it, it was an eye-opener, it really was. Even now, look at some of these bands that are heralded as the next big thing, and I think, wow, they're not very good players, are they?
Mm.
Yeah, you can write a song, but it's just a pop song, and it's not quite, yeah, you know, Hallelujah, the saviours of music people. It's not quite Charlie Parker or Stravinsky. Yeah. It's not. I do understand the merits of pop music, but I think I hold it very lightly, and I now see it as an industry. You know, and even from, you know, the other side, when I first released solo records, getting all the bills and dealing with innately seeing such a massive insight in the industry that I've never seen. So I was in charge of all my funding for the album advance I got. I had to pay for racking. I didn't realise you had to pay for racking. So when HMV would put your album in the racking under R, you paid for that.
No.
You paid for that.
So do you?
Yeah, yeah. And or you're in FOP. You know, on the front.
Yeah.
FOP's pick of the week. That was like 270 quid a week. I didn't know any of that stuff. So here's me. You know, I've just come out of Baby Shambles. Well, I was still in Baby Shambles at the time. And I'm getting all these bills. And yeah, and to get racked is this. And then, oh yeah, do you want to be on the front of iTunes? Okay, so if you just do this. And it's like, wow. It took me to another level, which normally, even being in the band, you wouldn't see, because this is dealt with, this is the fine structures of releases.
And I can totally see how that would then either consciously or subconsciously affect your artistic output.
Of course.
It would compromise it, wouldn't it? Because you're thinking, I'm putting this, so I want to get this much return on it.
That's the other problem with PR as well, the billboard. You know, I remember seeing some of the rough trade budget for the billboard. And it's great for your ego and your swagger to walk around and get your photo taken underneath your number, whatever, and then you realise, well, that's just cost $6,000.
Wow. You
know? And that's the game. And it did put me off a bit, but it is the game. And just little old me is not going to change it. That's why I say now, you know, I still have like a couple of toes in the industry because I still release, but I do it more on my own terms now. It's much more healthy for me, I think. I don't want to be dragged into that whole... I don't have the hunger anymore either. I'm not going, right, this album's going to be the one. I'm really happy. The biggest buzz for me is when I sit and I write. The moment it's kind of pressed to vinyl, I'm kind of disinterested. It's gone.
It's gone.
Everyone said, oh, you're going to tour it? I said, well, I don't really want to. Do I have to? No, because it's not like it's because it's crowdfunded. So I don't have to tour it. So thus, no. I might do a gig if I want to.
Yeah.
But I don't find gigging that easy and I don't find it that enjoyable. So why should I do it?
In your experience, what are you finding the most common root cause behaviours of those in the music industry that are coming to you?
It's different, really. I think, as I said earlier, I think people bring their own history.
Or then, how does it compare to the people not in the music industry?
I think it's much the same. People are people, and I think the industry can... You know, my whole thesis is about... There was a big report done recently that the music industry makes you sick. Music, you know, by Help Musicians UK, music is innately healing, blah, blah, blah. Music industry makes you sick.
And really? Okay,
yeah, it's Help Musicians UK. They've just done the second report. And it's really insightful, but my PhD thesis goes into, okay, I get that. And if we're going to have binary thinking, that's true, probably. But what about people that, A, get their narcissistic needs met in industry? And there's a few kind of classic, I don't know if you know, psychologists or... A guy called Cohen, a guy called Winnicott, that said someone like who's got a narcissistic disorder who continues about me, never got that met as a kid. Mm. So his standpoint from therapy is to give them that. So when they're talking about all this me, they kind of go with it because a kid needs to go through that developmental process. So one of my angles in the thesis is when people are in the industry and they're heralded, that's getting those needs met.
Yeah.
Now you would hope that by getting those needs met, they move to the next developmental stage. Doesn't really happen, but that is an example of the positives of being held aloft as a high status performing artist.
So you're saying there are merits in...
There are merits. Yeah. I mean, when I first started researching, I expected to hold both. As I go on, there is more dysfunction than the merit, I think, because of the nature of being commoditized. But again, you know, it's not about attacking the industry because I think that's there for a reason. And everyone can go, I'm not a product man, I'm not this. But, okay, in that case, you can stay at home and make loads of songs and demos, that's cool, and do your day job. But if you're going to step into the arena of commoditization, you are going to be a commodity. That's how it is. Yes, there isn't an argument and there is a ground for a duty of care in the middle ground. I agree with that, and that needs to happen. But you're entering the domains of the never two shall meet. You know, it's this... sensitive creative artist, and this person he says, I'm going to market you and get you loads of money so you can continue being a sensitive creative artist, and they kind of merge and mutate and form in the middle as one. And then it becomes a bit problematic because the artist is saying, hold on, as I did, I'm on this, you know, this merry-go-round. The other point, well, you know, I put a big deposit down on a mortgage. I could never have done that as a school teacher teaching music. I did when I first come out of the industry from that way. I was really kind of a bit angry about it. But the more I went on, I thought, well, this is it. I did have a choice. No one held a gun to my head, so you must stay in this industry.
Yeah.
So
I try. What would you have done differently?
I think probably wouldn't have indulged as much. I think I wouldn't have. For me, the industry, the biggest thing I got out of the industry was a sense of status and a sense of worth, a sense of propulsion, of elevation. It's the best.
Those tendencies you talked about a moment ago. No,
I said there was definitely a need for that for me, self-worth. I got a lot of that out of it. Of course, financially, it was amazing. And the music was good. I thought there was a point when it, when you've created, that's the most exciting point for me. But when you're having to tour the same stuff over and over again, then the merit becomes about, you know, the drinking and all that that comes after it. That's when it's great. But what would I do again? Yeah, I think I wouldn't.
Would you do differently?
I would. Of course, it's in hindsight, and I wouldn't have had the self-knowledge to have known. I was blind then. I didn't know that the status and the elevation was so potent for me. It lifted me from not quite getting what I needed growing up, through nobody's fault, just from that environment. It filled a massive hole of worth and status.
Yeah.
So being held aloft in that situation, I think I was blindly in that, I didn't know. It was only from coming out of that and trying to unpick from my own, you know, being a service user of therapy, unpicking why has this collapse of this journey impacted me so much. Okay, financially, yes. Musically, yeah, it was all right, but I can still make music. There's nothing stopping me from Baby Shambles or from at home. I can still do that. Status, and the biggest thing was the sense of status and the elevation of being that guy, you know, signing the autograph. And I guess we were lucky that we were a band that was at the pinnacle of the media at the time when bands were at the pinnacle of popular culture, musically, really, when the pendulum was swinging back in bands. So for me, it was this amazing elevation, and that was the biggest thing I got out of it, really. And unpicking that journey and seeing why it was so alluring for me was the biggest revelation. So I think if I was to do it again or have my time again, hopefully I'd have the knowledge to not step into that role as deeply as I did, and just to stand back and enjoy it rather than, because I think I clung on, you know, was clinging on for quite a long time, thinking, God, this defines me now. And it's almost like a sense of cutting off my past and becoming this new person. So all the other stuff I'd experienced, it doesn't matter anymore. I'm here. Ta-da.
Yeah.
And of course, none of us can do that.
One story I heard that you mentioned back in the day when you were in the band was that I think you were doing some recording and Pete needed some support. And I think, was it right that some military guys were kind of put to look after you?
Yeah, they were,
sure,
yeah.
Now, given your vantage point now, do you think that's a good approach? Is that a sensible approach? Was there merit to that approach? Or
he had to, it was part of a court order. So part
of a court order. Okay.
Because he was continually at that point, you know, every other week he'd be nicked for drugs. And it was part of a court order that Rough Trade had negotiated through his lawyer to say that, okay, he'll be allowed out or he'll be on probation for this. He was on probation anyway, then he got nicked for something. So rather than sending him down, they managed to negotiate that for the duration of recording down in Albion, he would be under, I don't even know why they were there. They had to be involved. It was almost like a condition of the court order that someone had to be like babysitting him or something. So there's two ex kind of military guys that were there. Yeah, it was quite funny. So it was part of the court order.
Right.
It probably didn't help.
It wasn't a treatment as such for him to kind of...
No, it wasn't. Right, no, I think it was part... Right. I think, I might be wrong. I can't have to go and read the book again, but I think it was part of a court order. And then it was, you know, there was a fight on stage in Brixton and they got involved then and helped kind of separate the brawling. It was a very messy time for everyone, I think.
The problems you kind of refer to back then, saw that Pete obviously frequently failed to turn up to gigs or turn up very late and that kind of thing, or not really much of a state of form, but when he did, it was obviously great. What techniques were employed to try and address that? It must have been such a difficult thing for you to be in the band.
Oh, it's hard.
Like, what did you try? And again, with your vantage point now, how would you deal with that situation?
I wouldn't have tried so hard. You know, I was clinging on to this because for me, it was probably, I felt, the one chance I've got.
Yeah.
And being that kid, you know, leaving school with nothing and feeling that sense of who am I, I'm not really worth much. This opportunity, bam, it's opportunity of a lifetime. So for me, I was clinging on for dear life, trying to keep everything together. And that's why I assume that managerial role when the strands are all out. I think if I don't keep this together, no one's going to do it. But in hindsight, I think I wouldn't have tried so hard. I think I would have just... But that's from going through the journey and getting to a point where I didn't need it so much. But I think, yeah, maybe not. I was almost burnt out by it, I think, in the end. And in the end, I just kind of give up. It's like, I think when you're dealing with somebody that's got substance problems, it doesn't matter. You can do as much as you want unless they're ready to do it themselves.
So what would you have done? What can be done in that situation? What advice would you give to someone dealing with that situation? If there are gigs, you got the pressure of paying your mortgage, all that kind of stuff. You want
realize
those gigs
that you are powerless. You know, I remember we'd done a big festival in Austria for, what was it? But it was like €250,000 lost.
Really?
Show up. Yeah, but then what happens is you get fined. So then the next spate of gigs is offset against that. And then you're continually playing kind of catch up. It's about... You know, I was desperate for it to work back then. And as time went on, I think it burnt me out and I've realised I haven't got much control over this. I think acknowledging the fact that I had very little control and there's only so much I can do and kind of cutting off from it and not being so impassioned and caring so much. I mean, that was my biggest downfall, caring. Because it seemed to be, no, everyone else was just like, oh, whatever.
Would that have changed things, though?
No, it wouldn't have changed anything externally, but it would have changed my own mental state.
Yeah.
You know, by the end of that one bit period, I was exhausted. You know, I think for me, the kind of collapse of it all just happened at the right time. I think I probably wouldn't be here now if it would have continued.
Wow.
You know, probably internally combusted or a breakdown or something. It was so much, I was really struggling. It was just like, looking back into it now, I think, whoa, I survived that and I got out. Because I think if you're heavily into... what I call the upper echelons of drugs, I think it gives you a very easy place to escape to.
Right.
But if you're not, you know, if you're just into more of the tepid stuff, it's not enough to deal with that mania. So you go one way or the other. You go, start frying your own brain, as I did, or you start taking more drugs to disconnect and just float along with whatever, man. You know.
And people in that position, what are they escaping from?
The tension. I think people are trying to escape from the tension. A, their own demons, but if you're in an environment like that, I think there's an innate tension of just keeping the band together on a daily basis. When you've got substance abuse issues within a framework like that, I guess if you call it a working relationship,
yeah.
You know, if you have one area of substance, you've got a hell of a big journey on your hand. If you've got multiple, I don't know how we've done what we've done. If I'm honest, you know, I think probably myself trying to push through these things, getting people to studios, you know, kind of calling around, getting people to rehearse this and do that. I think about it now and, you know, there's talk and we're in kind of conversation with Pete and he sends me a few messages. So we've got to hook up and get in the room together and I've got an idea and all this. And
nice.
I'm just like, yeah, cool. I'll go with it. I'd no longer feel that, like, right, what are we going to do? Was maybe... 5-6 years ago, I'd have been like, oh, right, let's do it. It's like, yeah, cool. You see, I'm doing my thing now.
Mm.
Yeah, I'll do a sabbatical. It'd be great. We'll go out and do the old hits and all that stuff and maybe write some new stuff. But it wouldn't be from the same viewpoint. You know, I feel I've got a lot more clarity from my own personal side of things and my narrative that it wouldn't draw me into the same level. It's a much safer place, I think. Of course, the allure of that's amazing and the feeling of it. And if it happens, you know, it'll be really fun. But it's not coming from the same place, whether that's age, whether that's, you know, all those years of sitting in front of someone and discussing narrative, who knows? But it's an interesting journey. It's been an interesting journey. When I think back to it, you know, talk about that now, I feel the mania. I feel the sense of, it's so exciting. But the other side of that is, it's just too exciting. You know, it's too much to bear for any human being.
So good in short bursts.
Good in short bursts. And I didn't have that, you know, and even come back from tours, you're still on the go all the time.
When you were in Baby Shambles, what was the blueprint for Baby Shambles that would differentiate themselves from Libertine Sound? So did you have like production meetings and stuff like that? And,
yeah, right.
Or was it very impulsive? Was it just?
It was very impulsive, and it was. I think it would change a bit because predominantly, I think Pete would write the stuff, and Pat's a very different guitar player. You know, he's a musician's musician. I think he comes from a similar place to me, rather than being a band person. You know, I think maybe Carl comes from more of a band background. I played with Pat a lot. We would just go to a room in the old days before the band and just play together. Right. He's very into Hendrix. I found him really, it's like playing with a jazz guitar player. It's like, it's all very musical. So I think from that angle, we had a bit more musicality in there going into it. I don't really know what else. I guess there's different, a lot of the stuff that Pete brought anyway, he would hold it already had written.
Yeah.
And I think you're going to get a unique influence anyway from all of the musicians in the band, especially as it's quite new and there's no, it was unwritten. I think with Libertines, I guess there's a, here's the hits, we know they work, so there's always going to be an allure to try and formulate the same stuff because it's quite safe and we know it. Not consciously, but I think it will just happen unless you get someone new and he goes, oh, let's work the whole thing totally different. So I don't know about the blueprint. I think just having different musicians in there really helped. I don't really know. I think musically it is different. I mean, it's less...
I was wondering if that was a conscious decision made by Pete or anyone like that. It wasn't.
I think probably from myself and Drew's background as well, you know, perhaps it was we were a bit more open. I think there is sometimes an element. And also, I think if you're a certain age, you're kind of boxed in by that kind of new wave sound. We didn't really have that.
So tell us about playing with Drew. So on the last episode, we had the man who's in a rhythm section with him at the moment. So we had Dan McDougall, Liam's drummer, on, and said he's the most chilled out bloke ever. What were the qualities he brought to the band as a musician and as a person?
I think he just stayed out of trouble a lot. I think he just kind of stood back, and it's probably in hindsight a much safer thing to do.
Yeah.
Just to stand back and sit on the fence and just like, you know what, I'm just here to do my thing. And I felt I couldn't do that because I felt if I didn't get involved and try and keep things together, which would inevitably cause more tension, the band would collapse.
Right.
And I wasn't, you know, I didn't come into it as being a session musician. I've never really been into that kind of, I struggle, the whole session thing. It just doesn't sit with me. It does, I think Drew come into it more from that perspective. You know, he was doing stuff with other people. He was like a working session musician. For me, it was more about, I want this band to be part of me.
Yeah.
I come from... You know, Beatles, Beatles, Stone Roses, all these bands, they would never kind of dart about and be in different bands. A band was a band, I felt. You know. And I'm not a great networker anyway. I find it really hard to try to impose into a social situation just for a merit of work. You know, I'd rather kind of lose the work if I didn't get on with someone. But, so that's probably what it worked in our framework. He just kind of kept out of it. And to my detriment, you know, I got stuff going, but I probably rattled a lot of cages by dragging people in and go, come on, we've got to do this.
But someone had to do that, like, to get the job
done.
Someone
had to do it.
Yeah.
And for me, it was vitally important for my own sense of self-esteem to keep that band going, because at that point, I was so enclosed with it, I thought, this is me. What do I have if I don't have this band? If I'm not validated by, you know, the bullshit of NME and media, who am I? You know, I got to such a point, it'd become internalised, and it's a very dangerous place to be. Because then you go working harder and harder and harder. And when you deal with substance, it doesn't matter how hard. You can run a million miles an hour. Someone, you're not going to change someone. Right. So I guess probably in the long run, he played the long game. And
It's all about Pete and writing. So would we be right in saying that he's quite an impulsive writer when he wrote new stuff? So when he wasn't doing stuff that he'd written previously, does he mull over his songwriting process a lot? Is it a case he writes something and goes, let's do it?
I think he just knocks it out and just and I think the producers for us deserve, you know, especially like Stephen Street deserves a lot of credit, because if it weren't for people like that stitching those parts together,
because
you've got your old songs that he brought to the table. I think Down and Albion was mostly all written before I joined. There's a couple of ones that weren't. And Shotters Nation, again, a few kind of older ones in there. But then it was someone like Stephen Street that would jigsaw it together. And the Blinding EP as well. You know, Drew and I sat hours and hours in Terminal Studio, literally cutting and pasting to make it together. Yeah. So it's bits and pieces, you know. And I think Pete is someone that's got so many creative ideas, but he needs a Carl, or he needs a Stephen Street. He needs someone to go, whoa, 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 whoa. There's too many bits in this song. You know, if we just take piece A and piece B, there's your song. You don't need C, D, E, F, G, you know, and it's stacking all over the place. Because he's so creative, he needs that element, that kind of container, I think. And someone like Stephen Street was great at that, because he would cut it and he'd say, no, that It's too much.
I think that's still the case. So I know someone who's kind of working with Pete, and he says he'll go to bed and he'll wake up in the middle of the night and he's got little kind of 1 minute long voicemails where it's like here's a bit of a song.
Wow.
And he's then finished it off and send it back, and then Pete's going, oh yeah, that was that song. You know, that's it's that kind of bit by bit approach. What would a young wordsmith or songwriter learn from working with Pete that they wouldn't necessarily learn from working with anyone else?
I think his unique approach. I mean, what we live in now is a musical world where it's the same old songwriters, you know, working with the same old people. You always, I can't remember his name, is it Greg Kurstin or someone?
Yeah.
It's like done all the new Lily Allen stuff and all that, and you think you get a very safe formula. I don't know who done the Liam stuff. Who was it? The
yeah,
same
Greg
guy?
Kurstin.
I've done all the Liam stuff as well, and you can hear it. It's just like, yeah. Man, I understand it's palatable, but you can hear he's listened back. Okay, what were your popular hits? We're going to read. It's almost like it can sound a bit sometimes like you're writing a commercial where someone's gone, we want this song, but we can't afford to pay for it. So can you do this? Which sounds a bit like it. And it's a bit like with someone like Pete, you're always going to get a unique, maybe cluttered and clustered human, fresh perspective on it, because he doesn't come from those. And this is what I think we're lacking now. I think we lack that openness to newer, obscure, kind of left-field ideas. And even with my solo stuff, you know, I call it quixotic odd pop, because it's the same kind of thing. Just throw it out there. And some people say, well, that middle eight doesn't quite go, but it's like, maybe it doesn't. But I'm not just going to go blam, 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 and it's boring. What's the point, you know?
So we talked about how being in the music industry and being reflective now has changed you as an individual and looking back. How do you think being immersing yourself in the world of this kind of psychotherapy has specifically tweaked your artistic output, either consciously or subconsciously?
I think definitely greater self-awareness. I listened to some of my early songs. I remember being in with the first producer, and he was saying, what's this song about? I'm like, I don't know. I just do like a kind of ramble, a kind of string of consciousness. And going back, I can see exactly what the songs were about. It's really interesting, because obviously for me, it was a platform to get stuff out. And I've never ever considered lyrics. People say, oh, can you write those lyrics down? I said, I don't even know what I wrote. You know, just for me, it's about the intonation of the syllables. Okay, it needs a new sound, that needs an R. And linguistically, that fits. The meaning was just superfluous. I didn't care. And going back, it's really interesting how the meanings kind of become quite subjective to different people, and I can see the meanings. So I don't know how it's really informed. There's definitely a lesser sense of bitterness, I think. I think when I was first writing, it was about you, done this to me, it's all you.
Yeah.
Now it's not. Now I can kind of, I can hold those things and almost take a bit more agency. So it becomes a bit less, you did this to me. It's a bit like, yeah, well, I can now sit and sing, write a song about how beautiful it is to do this or to do that. So I think through self-reflection, it's become a lot less, probably less anger, you know, in me, which has been helpful.
Other than actual experiences, what were the skills you learned in the music industry that were valuable that you've been able to transfer to what you do now?
I think that probably not much, really, in terms of being in that environment. You're talking about very two different environments. An environment where it's necessary to not be your authentic self. You'll get artists saying, yeah, we're really real, but I figure that's total bullshit. I don't think anyone is totally real. I think there's a necessity to bend into your commoditized validation of people think you are. I think when I sit with people, I'm trying to go the other way. I'm trying to say, look, I'm not impressed by all that stuff. You know, I've been on this journey as well. It's really interesting. I'm lucky enough that I get people to come to see me because they can't find another therapist that they feel will really get what it's like.
Yeah.
You know, when you're talking about all that hedonism and how it really feels, it's like, yeah, I get it. I've been there. I've walked the walk. And I continually do. You know, I continually tour and do whatever it takes. But I think from that perspective, it's kind of opposite. I think one's a very human, real connection between two human beings, leaving the bullshit outside, you know. And this is where I think the growth is for people, because some people have gone so far down that other road B that they've got so far away from who they are. This is where the problem comes. This is where they're so far away from their authentic self that they need drugs to be able to live like this. And I know that feeling. I know how that feels, this continual pressure. Who am I? Where am I? Which is great when there's someone blowing smoke up your ass every day. You're great. But when that's no longer validated, then you really see it for what it is. Or through whatever, some kind of fracture or something happens. And you see it and you think, wow, how far? Because it takes that 1 degree, like a ship, one degree off over the years, and before you know it, you've come to a whole nother area. And because I'm not, they can't play that card with me. They can't play the look at me card. They can try, but it's like, I'm not having it. I'm not impressed by that. It's such a different environment from being in the music industry or any industry where, A, there's a surplus, so you're considered lucky to be doing it. B, there's an immense amount of wealth. There's an immense amount of status, and it's media fueled. You know, when you're in that environment, it can be quite dangerous. And it takes a very strong person to remain grounded. I'm sure there are a few bands that have got through it. My experience with people is that stuff's irrelevant. It's not irrelevant to where you're at, but in terms of me seeing you as a human being, that's the core. It's that, you know, I'm a relational psychotherapist, so the core is our relationship. And I think people lose that in the industry because you don't know who to trust. And you suddenly got this great group of mates around you. You're all out having a great, like, get you in anywhere. And the next thing, they're not even answering the phone to you. And that hurts. You know, you're like, wow, you were my best mate. You know, we'd kind of bunked up together, not in a sexual way, but, you know, in that kind of rock and rollness, you know. And then the next thing, you just brushed aside like a product. And there was a lot of when I experienced that, a lot of anger and upset and bitterness. But then you pick it apart and you realise, okay, well, stupidly and naively, I thought I wasn't involved with a commoditisation, but you are. And there's nothing wrong with that because it has to be that way for you to earn money and then to earn money. It's a business. Yeah. You know, I think it's a very tough dichotomy for an artist to be businessized anyway. So when I sit there, it's just about two human beings that have had similar experiences and trying to almost help somebody to rekindle that sense of just being them. Because where else can they do that? They can't. Even when they're out with their mates, they've still got the status of, oh, you're in that band, weren't you? You know, you're the lead singer. Or the classic is, you used to be in that band. You know, you're that person. And I know that feeling from my side. I'm lucky enough now I can lean into that and go, yeah, I used to be that guy in the band, but I lean into it and I take that coat off. You know, like I'm here, and I probably wouldn't be here if I wasn't the guy who used to be in that band, the guy that used to go out to Kate Moss, you know, the trail. But I can wear that coat, and then I can take it off. And I never had that luxury before, because, of course, you don't want to just disengage from that. But I think a lot of people do, and they become that. And when I'm in, you know, sitting with therapy with someone, it's about them. It's about, right, what? Who are you? Tell me about yourself. Let's lose this. What about when you're growing up? Who were you? Some people are reluctant to go there because it's such a place they don't want to be back to, and this has heralded them in this new environment. So, yeah, it's about seeing the real person, I think, which the industry doesn't really do that much. And why should it?
Yeah. You know? So I grew up in Hornchurch in Essex. Yeah. And I know you used to play lots of gigs in and around Romford with Ian Punter and stuff like that. I went to school with someone called Laura, who I remember in 1997, we were at school in a drama class, me and my mate Mark Buckley, and it was the height of the whole kind of Oasis, I think B&L was coming out the week that Liam shaved his head, Liam and I shaved the head. And she went, oh, you like Oasis? I was like, yeah, love them. Right? And she said, oh, Liam's coming over for dinner on Sunday. And we laughed at her in the way that you would, because it was like saying, oh, Elvis is coming over for a cup of tea. And she went, no. Alan White, the drummer, was taught by my dad, Bob, and he's coming over on Sunday. He's bringing Liam. Oh, wow. And that's how I learned about Bob Armstrong. And he was obviously an absolute legend, so respected in the industry as a drummer, as a drumming teacher. Sadly, passed away last year. And Laura will be actually listening to this. I spoke to her earlier today. Yeah. So I wonder if you could tell us, what were his specific qualities as a teacher and a person?
I think his reputation preceded him, you know, always being a drummer and reading like River magazine and all his periodicals. And he was always the guy that I wanted to get to. It took me like 2 years I was on his waiting list. And then I remember kind of going down the garden in Hornchurch because he would be teaching from his little kind of shed area, being in awe of this guy. And what was it about him? I think there was no bullshit. There was no fluff. He didn't have to sell you himself. Because you knew the lineage of players he'd had. And I think somebody that has a reputation is 75% of it, because you're just going to toe a line. And I'm back to basics. And this was like 2 years before Baby Shambles, 2003. And I'd been doing a lot anyway. And I was just waiting to... I was going to his pupils to get lessons and waiting for a space to become available. And I remember just going totally back to basics. And it turns out he was the first one. I'd always had a knee problem. I didn't realise it. And after the first year, he'd be looking at my knee and he'd just say, you know, your knee's kind of curling in. I'd play like this. I had a martial arts accident years ago. And it transpired that I couldn't actually, there's got some tendon problems, which had never, ever been kind of sorted out. He was the first person that said, you need to look at that somehow because there's something not right down there physiologically with your leg. Yeah. And
so that would have been your bass drum, would that have been?
Me and my kick drum, yeah. It's always a massive, even now, I don't have the control because at that point I was aspiring to be like a session drummer. Just to play by play and realizing that I've got like about 50% efficiency in that leg, so I was never going to have the control. And it was heartbreaking for me, but we concentrated on other stuff, you know, we'd look at it and go, yeah, there's something not right there. But so that was the side journey.
Yeah.
But regarding him, it was just that sense of, I don't know, it was pure trust. That's what it was. When you're a musician, especially me, who's always kind of, I guess, trying to work out whether people are doing the best for you at that point. Having a teacher like that, you could just relax. It's like, oh, that's been taken care of. I know now. I just do what he tells me. He said, you give me 2 hours a day, which I did. So you've done your 2 hours a day, and in 2 weeks, I'd see him every other week. And he'd write like one sentence. It's almost like this blind trust because of his prestige. So that's what I got out of it, this trust, which is really hard to find in a teacher. Sometimes, even now when I have guitar lessons, I'm kind of second-guessing a bit and thinking, I've read that's a bit different. But with him, it was just like, I had none of that. It's just, you just know, just from his, you know, his prestige, that's where it is. And yeah, I remember him funding it. And then when I joined Baby Shambles, thinking, I'm in Baby Shambles now. Bob was like, well, you're not going to come to your lesson then. I was expecting him to go, ooh, great. And I was like, here's a good fuck. You know, it's like, well, and I remember, yes, it knocked me a bit because I know my status had been elevated. But of course, to him, you know, he's working with high caliber bands. And he expects, well, even if you're touring with UT, whatever, you still come to your lesson every other week. He comes down, he'd moved into an industrial place, that's wherever it was, but he'd moved out of his house.
Yeah.
And I was kind of, I was a bit knocked by that, thinking, do you not know who I am? It's really, in hindsight, it makes me laugh, because why would he? You know, just some little bod in some little indie band. But it was funny, and I unfortunately had to stop, and he questioned it. He said, are you sure you want to do this? Regarding stopping, I said, well, I just don't have time, because in the band, which is so sporadic, I couldn't have committed. I couldn't have said to them, guys, every other week on a Thursday from 6 to 7, I'm doing it. It just wouldn't have worked. You know, someone like Pete, you're on call 24/7. It's not that. So now, you know, he was a legend. And I think, I don't know, hopefully there's these, you know, there's some other people that had that same prestige as he has. I don't really know. I've been trying to find a guitar teacher with the same level, but I haven't managed it yet. Just blind trust. It was just like, I trust this guy innately in terms of my own musicality, which was, you know, the most important thing for me at that time. I think that's what it was.
He was a great man. He had a great impact on the music industry.
He did, yeah.
In the UK.
Yeah.
The other person I wanted to speak to you about briefly before you have to shoot off was Lee Mavers. Did you collaborate in some way? Like, was it a joke when you said for 2 days you were in the Lars?
I was briefly in the Lars, yeah. I was, so I think most people, it's
talk
like
us through that from beginning
it's like
to
the fall, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, Drew was, no, I think I was in the last twice. Right, the one was for about a day. We were playing Liverpool's Baby Shambles, and then I think, you know, after a drunken night of revelry, he decided that we're going to be the Lars. So Baby Shambles become the Lars. So that was the first time we were in the Lars. So we'd all jam in the dressing rooms and writing songs, and we were the Lars, and we decided that, you know, on one of those moments, whatever we were doing, we're going to be the Lars. So we were playing and writing stuff as the Lars. That was the first time we were in the Lars. Then it fizzled out. But I was in the Lars for about 24 hours. Because we were his backing. We went from being his backing band. And then Pete, I think, didn't show up. And we became the Lars. And another time, then he came down to London. We were in someone's kitchen. I can't remember who organised it. For 2 days, it was like, right, I've got these gigs booked for Brixton Academy. I've got this, da 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 da. We need to rehearse this body of songs. So I remember just being in the kitchen with him, jamming all his songs, bass player. Guitar player, and no, it's got to be more. He said, like, listen to the fridge, it's got to be more like that. All right, just trying to work out what he meant. So it was all
what
going.
Did he mean?
I don't really know. So listen to the fridge and stuff like that. Listen to the birds. It was really so. I just jam along, you know, doing it, stay up all night, whatever. And then all these gigs were booked. And then, right, guys, next week I'll come down again. And then, well, you know, I think, okay, this will be a slow thing, a weekly thing, we'll do. And just dissipated, nothing happened. That was that. So.
Wow.
But I kind of expected that as well. I had to think, right, this is going to be it. Because Shambles was going as well then anyway, so it was just fun. But yeah, I was in the Lars briefly. But I guess most people have been in the Fall, isn't it? Oh, I was in the Fall, yeah, 1984, for a month.
One particular song that I loved listening to your solo stuff we listened to over the last couple of days, Bletchley Park.
Yeah, Bletchley Park.
Tell us about recording that. It's a beautiful song. And there's a particular lining about the Rats and Cats on tour. Was that linked to...
I think it was. I think I was really angry at the time. And I kind of felt that saying one thing wrong, it's going to lose my head, is the lyric in that song. Kind of off of his head again. It was such a paranoid time in that band. Everyone was kind of like... you're going to get sacked. No, you're going to get sacked. And I just thought, you know what? This is just like, it's horrible. It's like, you know, I kind of imagine being at the King's Court where who was ever the cardinal at the time would be in somebody's ear and you're going to get sacked. It's real paranoid time.
Yeah.
And that's what it was like. It was just everyone was looking at each other. Who's going to get sacked next? And of course, you know, I kind of grew up in Bletchley and Bletchley Park. I was thinking I'll get a sink out of it. It never really came to anything. Yeah, so that's that really. And I always
it's
like
a beautiful song. It's like, it's a very, you should be proud of that. That's a really beautiful song. And your father, I believe, is that right? Yeah. How does fatherhood change your artistic output, either subconsciously or consciously? Does it ever creep in that you think, oh, my kids might hear this one day, so I might?
I don't know, not that especially, really. I mean, they're still listening to like Man's Not Hot and Gangnam Style.
So like it doesn't, but it doesn't, you're not thinking in 10 years' time they might listen back to this, or and it, does
yeah,
it affect
no,
the way
I
you write?
No,
or?
It doesn't affect the way I write at all. The biggest impact, I think, is A, practicality, trying to work around all the practical stuff about having kids, and also touring. You know, touring's harder because I don't really want to be away too much. I think I really kind of feel it's get back. Although when I'm back, I'm like, I've got to get out, man. So there's that dichotomy between those two things. But regarding writing, no, I don't think it's really had a big impact.
Well, on the writing, obviously there's a famous quote, which is something along the lines of, life begins on the edge of your comfort zone. And I know once you said, I didn't want to play acoustically for a while. So I set about using a combination of computer-generated sounds and more affected guitars. Mm. What advice would you give to someone stepping away from whatever their safety net is, if you like, the comfort zone? What advice would you give? Because did you feel vulnerable kind of doing...
I felt less vulnerable.
Oh, did you? Right,
yeah, because I was hiding behind production.
Right.
I think when you're stripped bare and somebody has recorded you with your playing and your voice, I think I also felt that I couldn't get the anger through that from using that instrumentation. So a lot of the sounds on that British Plastic are really quite harsh. It's quite brutal.
Yeah.
In places. And
it's effective. It's effective.
Yeah. And, you know, I was listening back to it. Sometimes you can't even hear the lyrics and I think, good. It just needed that, that anger, because I was quite angry at the time. And I felt less vulnerable. It was almost like I could hide behind it. And then we went out and we toured to a backing track, because there's no way we could have recreated that. So it was a great release to just put a backing track on and just, you know, blast through some chords, and there was so much being contained, we could effectively all stop playing and there'd still be a sonic environment. Whereas if I'm touring, like the last thing I've done was last year, it's just me and acoustic, because the latest EP is boiled right the way down.
Someone got jigsawed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's all good boiled down, it's me and the guitar. And that's much more vulnerable, because there's nowhere to run. And any of the struggle I have now in doing gigs like that is I've got to remember what my fingers are doing, I've got to remember the lyrics, I've got to remember the pitch correctly. It's really hard. Was that? It's just like... I think it's a lot less exposing electronic music. I think you get away with it a lot. And I don't know whether that's indicative of the way people are, you know, the social media, where people are not being as authentic and exposing themselves. We all can on social media well, but it's not real. And I don't know whether that's indicative. I was thinking recently, is that because we live in more of a technologically enhanced environment now? Everyone's photoshopped, everyone's got a six-pack, everyone's looking great with their filter. Is that transpiring into music now, because everything's polished and nothing's raw and real anymore, because our ears are used to that? Even going back to Baby Shams recording a live band album, you know, now you've got, that's not just the sound of a snare, the sound of a snare with a few other snares underlaid it, so it's consistent for radio. Mm. Just on that very basic thing, there's a bit of auto-tune in there, there's a bit of juice bass went down a bit there, compressed and popped up.
Yeah.
Listen to a Stones recording and you'll hear it. You'll hear a real sound of a live band. And I kind of think, is that what we've come to? Things have to be processed just enough now for us to be palatable, just to ingest it. And that was a good thing about Down and Albion. That was like, it's like, you know, kind of genitals hanging out, really. Mm. It was like that compared to Shotters Nation. It does exhaust your ears, listen to Down and Albion. And Stephen Street done a great job of commercialising it, and that was his job. He needed to do that. And again, commercialised it, commoditised it for us. We got bigger claim. We sold more records because it was more palatable. But I do think there's something to be said about a little demo thrown out there. My last master's thesis, I sent out my 10 demos, me, raw, and guitar, and my 10 songs produced, and then got feedback, and then, you know, drew a whole thesis from it.
Interesting.
And realised that, have we become a society now, we just have to have processed, are we just, we live in a processed food environment, processed visuals, and what's happening to pure human interaction?
Yeah.
And what I do in a therapy room, it, that's it. I don't want any of that bullshit in, you know. And I bring myself into it, you know. It's not like I'm a blank screen. It's all about me reflecting what I'm feeling back to you and us. People are lacking that these days. They're lacking a real relationship.
As music, as your appetite for changing and evolving your techniques musically, do you have to, as it's always a new science, I guess, this area, do you have to kind of evolve your approach and have an open mind about how to approach supporting people with mental health issues, that kind of thing?
What regarding?
Yeah, so if you compare, so there's lots of, obviously, so I think the treatment you offer is around relational and psychoanalytical models, is that right?
Yeah.
But how does that compare to CBT, and will that kind of evolve over time? And
well,
will
I think
need to
CBT isn't relational. I think CBT is A, how you think about stuff.
Yeah.
There are some, but, you know, I know people that go, they'll get a phone call, they'll get a CD-ROM, and don't forget, CBT training is a one-year training course. You don't have to have any real therapy yourself. So you could be working with a therapist that has no knowledge of how they're impacting you at all.
Right.
And they're delivering this model. They're going to their book and go, okay, he's got trauma. So, okay, here's your negative automatic thoughts. Can you write a diary of all this stuff? From my perspective, I believe that it's to do with us as two relational beings. You know, people will argue that as well. So the healing is in two human beings being seen. That might take years for someone to truly be seen, you know. And I think
what does being seen look? What do you mean by being seen?
Being seen for the person that they are,
gotcha.
Not what they're projecting. You know, sitting with someone that's had such shit experiences that they think they're unlovable. Kind of sounds cliche, but sitting there and accepting them, you know, and it's more than that. But it's just formulating a relationship, and I think that's where the growth comes. I think I think you can patch up. You know, I use a few CBT things to patch people up, i.e. give them something to feel like, okay. But I do believe it's in that connection. You know, it's in that connection where after a few months you can say to someone, you know, when you did that, it made me feel a bit like this. Then people go, wow, that's how I impact people. And we can call it mentalizing as well, where you learn to know yourself through the eyes of another, which most people that come to therapy maybe didn't have that experience growing up. So the CBT thing then kind of falls on its backside a bit, I think. But, you know, some will kind of argue that, and some will say, oh, you know, whatever. So there's different theories on it. I believe my experience, I wouldn't have got anything out of CBT. I think I needed, you know, I needed another human being to sit with me through some of my stuff.
Yeah.
And to explore it in a relationship rather than challenging my negative automatic thoughts. I think that stuff is really helpful as a layer on top.
Yeah.
And as a patch up, okay, this is what's happened this week. Okay, keep these thoughts. And it gives you this sense of agency as well, but it doesn't ever last to the depth. You know, we call it depth therapy, where you're really... And of course, that takes a bit longer.
Okay. Final question then. I'm guessing that a lot of the musicians that you see have probably hit... I'm presuming this, but a lot of musicians you see maybe have hit their peak and are on the kind of trying to reach the same peak as they might have hit before. If there's musicians listening now who are on that kind of journey up before they hit that peak, what are the interventions or behaviours they should look out for or bring into their day-to-day lives, meaning that they might not necessarily need to see someone later on down the line, would you advise?
Yeah, I think it's about self-awareness. I think you can't get that level of depth of self-awareness until you've sat with someone in a safe environment. And there's no safe environment. There's no real safe environment to do it unless you're in a therapy, I believe, because whether it's your partner or whatever, there's always going to be an energy. It's going to be something you don't really want to say. And so I think it's self-awareness. I think if you're aware that, from speaking personally, you're aware that the music industry for you is very alluring because of that sense of status.
Yeah.
You know, it's going to be different for everyone, but speaking for me, then... just tread carefully on that. Be a bit mindful about why you're being dragged into this. Because then it gives you the agency. Yeah, go with it. But you know this is the choice I'm making, rather than you're just blindly in this situation.
Mm.
Like most of us are blindly in a relational pattern that we don't even know that we've grown up from the past, and that's how our caregivers, that's what they gave us. They've done the best they could. It's not their fault. But this is how we relate. Because if we don't relate this way to our caregivers, innately our brain tells us we're going to die because we're not going to be looked after. So it's primal, you know, it's Darwinian.
Yeah.
This is how we have to relate to the caregivers, what they're giving us, because if we don't, we're going to be neglected, annihilated, whatever. It's biological. So then we have that pattern, and we don't even know it until you're in a room with someone and say, you know, when you've done that, it really impacted me. Because nowhere else you're going to get that.
Yeah.
No one else is going to confront you. And it's not confrontational, because the relationship's formed and it's a very authentic, open relationship where you have the comfort of being able to really test out this. Wow, that's interesting. You know, I'm doing it disservice by making it quite binary, I guess. But there is that element of interaction in a relationship of therapy where you can be really honest and open with someone and say, wow, you know, and it takes a long time for the penny to drop sometimes.
Mm.
And people you see go, oh, person I've been talking about for 2 years that's really pissing me off, that's what I do. You know, again, I speak for myself on that situation. You know, I'm very much, it's not a me and you, me and them, you know. I'm not the therapist, you're the patient. I'd come at it from that level of, we co-create this together. You know, this is whatever you bring, I'm bringing something as well. Maybe that'll make you react a certain way. We're going to react. This is what's going to happen.
And if someone isn't in the point of an emergency case and they can't afford it, what should someone do? Because generally, I mean, this is in the UK, we're talking perspective here, but my understanding is that if someone needs that kind of level of support, they only get it through the NHS if it's like a really emergency case or it's quite a long wait. So what advice would you give in that situation? Because you've probably got a lot of people who probably think, no, I don't want to take up that service.
Yeah.
So what?
Well, that's interesting, because somebody said, I don't want to take up that service. What is that saying about them? Does it say they're not worthy of that service? Is there a reluctance?
They're more important, but there might be a case that they feel that someone else is more may need that resource more than they do.
Yeah.
In an emergency.
But that's a whole other area to kind of reflect on that person and say, yeah. Well, why is it? Why are you letting someone supersede their importance? Because, I mean, there's a crisis thing. If someone's in crisis, then it's out of my jurisdiction. I don't deal with that stuff. So there's a whole NHS crisis intervention. But, somebody that from that example saying, oh, I don't really deserve this, you know, that'll probably be reflected other points in their life, and probably that way of relating has got to the point where they might need therapy because everything they're doing is because someone else is more worthy of this.
Mm.
So there's exploration of that. I'm very aware that, because I do spend a day in NHS, it's interesting because I hear about all these waiting lists, but the surgeries I'm at, the waiting lists are like 1-2 months, and we do 7-week blocks of existential psychotherapy. It's not CBT. So I guess I'm not too sure about, I mean, I know different parts of the country, IAPS and stuff, they'll farm you out in different areas. They're trying to, I mean, it gets a bit complex, but they're trying to sell it on to the commissioning groups. The commissioning groups are the ones that hold the money in NHS, and they say yes or they say no. CBT, because it's considered as a evidence-based treatment, which, again, if you look into it, it's not really. It's been proven now that it's about the relationship, I think. I think they offer it out because it's a cheaper alternative. They can train people up in IAP CBT in a year. The first stage, from what I hear, is you'll get a phone call, CBT phone call. And then you'll get a CD-ROM, and you'll get in and have, like, 7 sessions. And I know people, like, from my background, that have done the CBT thing, and they say, you know, sometimes it is, but sometimes it's just not enough.
Yeah.
It's just not enough because, you know, you're trying your best, and it can be quite shaming. You've given someone about their gnats and all this stuff, negative automatic thoughts for people that don't know.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's about, we think of ways this way, and they're writing it all down, they're jumping all through these hoops, and they've come out of it, and they think, I still feel just as shit. And that has a massive impact on someone. They go, okay, so I can't be helped. Therapy doesn't work for me. It can be really shaming. I'm not good enough. I'm not even good enough to have therapy. It can't even help me. There's those two areas. There's probably more, but it can have quite a detrimental effect. Because CBT, really, in the whole body of therapy, it's like 5% against all the other kind of types there are. So there is that side I'm quite wary of with CBT as well. People come through it and they have such a bad experience.
Yeah.
Sometimes, you know, some CBT therapists, if they're working for the NHS, they've got 8 people a day.
Yeah.
You're the 8th one of the day. You know, what are you going to get?
Yeah.
But because it's a modelised version, I guess they can deliver it a bit more like that. They can say, okay, here's this person. They've got this, this, and this. And here's what we do for it. Which is a bit different to how I work, really. I see more just a person. And yeah, we're all struggling.
It's your approach seems to be more fluid. And adaptable.
I do think there is a point for CBT. I do think it can be really helpful for some people, but I think more often than not it's the depth stuff. It's sitting with another human being and sitting being there through it and experience that emotion, that's where the connection is.
Yeah. Cool. Okay. Well, thank you so much for appearing on the stage of the podcast. If people did want to get in touch with you and get in touch with the Music and Mind stuff, where would they go to? What's the name of your website?
Just musicandmind.co.uk. It's a holding page. I try and update the blog as well about things that I'm interested in, which covers, you know, I call it the trinity of the music industry, really. It's music itself. So what is great for our mental health about music, and what is, you know, what does it give us? The environmental factors of being in the industry, the late nights, the booze, you know, the lack of security, and the psychological part of it, which is the status, the value, the self-worth, the narcissistic part, good and bad, you know. So I kind of, that's the whole of my thing, is the thesis of those three parts of that coin of the music industry, really.
Fascinating. Thank you so much for what you're doing within the music industry. What you've identified and what you're kind of looking at the moment, it's not only much needed, but a critical intervention in some cases. So kudos to you. We look forward to seeing how Music and Mind grows. And we hope you enjoyed it.
Just another thing to finish with, if anyone's really struggling, the charity Help Musicians UK have just launched a helpline, 24-hour helpline. So if you're in the industry, whether that be, you know, doing merch, anything to do with the industry, they've just launched a free helpline. And then there's a triage, so you can get some therapy through them, and it's being funded. So, but I don't think it's being used to as much as it should be.
Right, okay. So, and who's that? Who's running
it? It's called Help Musicians UK. So if you just Google Help Musicians UK, there's a, it's a free for musician service. And because it's not being used as much as it should, these things, if it's not promoted, they might be in danger of losing some of their funding. So I always try and promote that.
Yeah,
that there's a resource there for people if they are musicians. I know, of course, there's a whole world of people that aren't, but as we're on this basis, I think, use it. You know, it's a service there. It's the only service, I think, in the UK that offers that. It's an initial port of call, a helpline, and then there's a kind of a kind of signpost in for therapy or whatever, CBC, animal therapy, whatever you need, I think. So it's worth checking it out if anyone's struggling.
Fantastic. Thanks very much for that.
Brilliant.
And I hope you enjoyed appearing. And
yeah, we'll do.
On the stage podcast.
Cool.
Cheers. See you later.
See you soon.